Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. In my never-ending quest to find mysterious kind of things, I found something really unusual. And essentially just some strange stories about families, about brothers, and just really, really odd things. And it was just random that I found, and I'm working on a thing that you'll hear later. Today, probably, about, of all things, you know, rock star wives, and somehow I got down a rabbit hole about brothers. And in 1980, 19-year-old Robert Bobby Schaffrin drove from his Scarsdale, New York home to attend his first freshman day at Sullivan Community College. He was local to the area, but, you know, he hadn't met any potential schoolmates as of yet. And he had not been popular in high school and hoped that making friends at college would be much simpler. As he pulled up to the college and parked his vehicle, people seemed really excited to see him. He thought, wow, what a warm welcome. College is way different than high school. And as the people approached him, they said things like, it's good to have you back here. One girl ran up to him, kissed him on the cheek and said, Eddie, oh my gosh, I'm so happy you're back. Bobby said, I think you have the wrong person, but I'll take the kisses. And the woman laughed and ran away. And the entire time he's trying to carry boxes up to his dorm room, people are smacking him on the butt, on the back, and cheering, yeah, he's back. So Bobby believes he's being pranked, but says nothing in return. And after unpacking, he stepped out of his dorm room to look down the hallway. And that's when yet another student sees him, starts feverishly waving and yelling, Eddie, come here, where have you been? And Bobby walked toward the man and explained it was a case of mistaken identity and he was new to the school. And the student looked puzzled, but listened. Bobby explained that everyone on campus was treating him like someone named Eddie, but he was not Eddie. And by the way, who's Eddie? Bobby asked. And the student looked at him perplexed and said, yeah, okay, Eddie. Well, good to have you back, I guess, and then walked off. Bobby's like, what is wrong with these people? Bobby just wanted time alone, so he shut himself into his dorm room and unpacks, only to hear a knock at the door. Dreading which idiot believes he is the mystery Eddie, this time he opens the door. The student who Bobby opens the door for looks white as a sheep. His face is completely gone of color. And the student asks him, who are you? Are you adopted? Bobby says, yes, as a matter of fact, I am adopted. The student said, is your birthday July 12th? And Bobby answered, yes. The student explains that his name is Michael Dominitz, and he's best friends with a man named Edward Eddie Galland, who attended that school, but by that particular year, Eddie took a break from studying and remained off campus. He explained to Bobby that Eddie is his exact twin, and this is why everyone believes Bobby is Eddie. Eddie is so well-loved on campus, and that's why everyone is so psyched that he's back. And Michael explains that Bobby and Eddie have to meet immediately, and he phones Eddie. And during the phone conversations, Michael is having, you know, is explaining to Eddie, this guy has to be your twin. It's crazy. I've never seen anything like it. You have to see this now. And as soon as Eddie and Bobby get on the phone together, their voices are identical, and you can't tell who's talking. So the two arranged to meet that evening, which required driving 2 hours from the campus to Eddie's home. And the guys are elated. As they pour out of the car and run up to Eddie's front door, the door flings open before they can even knock. And this puts Eddie and Bobby standing nose to nose in front of each other. Identical clones. They can't believe it. They stared at each other for minutes. And local media picked up on the story and was obviously interested in knowing more. I mean, who wouldn't want to know more? Two identical twins just happened to end up at the same college, and their friends bring them together. Wild. So months later, this New York Newsday was one of the first to publish the article in which David Kelman, a student at Queens College, saw the news story about the reunited twins and recognized his own face in the photos. He called Eddie's house and got his mother, who said, oh my God, they're coming out of the woodwork. David explained to Eddie's mother that all three guys had distinctively enormous hands that stood out to people. David points out that all three of the guys were born on July 12th and at the same hospital. So after speaking to Eddie, and David, and Bobby, they all set up a time for all three of them to meet. And within minutes of meeting each other, they're wrestling each other, joking, and acting as if they'd known each other their entire lives. You could tell they were triplets. So Newsday had to reprint the story to reflect that three triplets had reconnected in life. And the public was hungry for information on how this happened. What was the story behind them being split up? Well, the triplets made their rounds on talk show circuits and in television interviews. And despite living apart, they each held similar habits. They smoked the same cigarettes, they all enjoyed wrestling, they kept the same hobbies, and liked the same type of women. The guys could finish each other's sentences, and their mannerisms were similar. Even though they were all raised separately, no one could tell. All three became very famous. They were offered exclusive VIP passes to celebrity clubs and hung out with Madonna. The brothers went on to make a cameo appearance in Madonna's 1985 film, Desperately Seeking Susan, which, in my opinion, is the only Madonna-worthy movie at all. And it's, you know, only because Roseanne Arquette kind of takes it. So, but it is by far the best Madonna movie. So one night, the triplets ran into celebrity photographer Annie Leibovitz. And she introduced herself as working for the Village Voice and Rolling Stone. And she wanted to photograph the brothers at the Peppermint Lounge and Mud Club. And David said, we were wearing these Izod Lacoste shirts. And like matching white jeans, going to places where people had multiple piercings and all kinds of color in the hair, we felt like virgins in a brothel. None of the parents who adopted a boy was told there was a brother, much less a twin or triplet. At least two sets of parents flew into a rage explaining that had they been told there were triplets, they would have adopted all of them. Except, as it turns out, the adoption agency was very sketchy. It would not, you know, have allowed that to transpire. That wasn't their motive. Now, the adoption agency was based in New York, Louise Wise Services. Now, not only did they have heavy-hitting lawyers, but big-time financial backers who would stop at nothing to protect them. And the most powerful people in New York at the time were utilizing the services of this adoption agency. Well, the parents requested a joint meeting with the executives of the adoption agency, and the agency agreed. And upon entering the meeting, the parents asked point blank, did you knowingly separate the triplets? And the executive said, yes, we did, because it's really hard to place three children into one home and have them all successfully reside there. And the agency stood by their decision, and they weren't interested in hearing which parents would have preferred to have done what. They provided each family with a healthy baby, and as far as the agency was concerned, they satisfied the parents' burden. Well, the parents left, believing there was more to the story, and the agency was lying to them. They didn't feel like they could pull any further information out of the agency, so they left. And now Bobby's father realized he had left a very nice umbrella in the meeting room, and instead of bothering anyone at the agency to fetch it, he snuck back in to quietly grab it. On his way in, he witnessed the agency brass cracking open a bottle of champagne and toasting each other for having pulled off some sort of ruse. The father didn't confront the men, but he felt like they were celebrating having successfully, you know, lied to the parents. Well, the parents decided to lawyer up. And at first, New York lawyers poured out of the woodwork to represent the triplets. But one by one, the firms backed away. The parents came to realize that the adoption agency was persuading lawyers and prominent clients to distance themselves from the case or have their own law partners have their own adoption chances damaged for meddling. You know, these lawyers had wives who desperately wanted babies, and their wives wouldn't understand the heartbreak of being told no after having waited so long. So the parents of the triplets, it's a dead end. And the sons decide, hey, can we just drop the subject for now? I mean, we have each other, and that was more important to them than anything. And the families enjoyed reunions, and the guys went on to get married and create families of their own. The guys decided to open a restaurant together in New York called Triplets. And for the first year, they were able to coast on their fame. The restaurant was, you know, wildly successful. But as time went on, the sparkle dulled and the brothers began to fight over finances. And this is where it showed the boys were, in essence, strangers. They hadn't grown up together. One didn't know what the other was capable of or what he wouldn't do or would do. And they began not trusting each other. Well, Bobby grew tired of the nonstop fighting and left the company. And since Bobby really was the most likable of the bunch and the glue that bound the restaurant and customers together, this was a severe blow to the business, and it folded. Eddie became severely depressed and had to be hospitalized. And right after he was released from medical observation, Eddie took his own life with a gun. And this was a crushing blow to the brothers and the families. Around this time, a journalist who was fascinated with writing about identical twins had stumbled across an obscure article about a medical study in which twins were intentionally separated at birth and then studied to see how they turned out. The journalist was floored to realize that all of the twins used in the study came from the Louise Wise Adoption Agency. And the journalist phoned Bobby and told him, based on the article, he needed to look into the subject. He told them it would be awful if they had been used in a scientific study. So the brothers were immediately furious at the thought of being treated like lab rats or guinea pigs. If they had not been separated at birth, then perhaps Eddie would still be alive. The journalist realized there would be multiple sets of twins affected, and after publishing this brand new study, sure enough, he was contacted by other sets of twins, including two females. The two female twins struggled significantly with depression and mental health issues, and they wanted to know why. In order to answer that question, they needed to know who their birth parents were and where they came from. Who were all of these parents giving up twins to the Louise Wise Agency? None of the families were seeking, you know, retribution or compensation, but they wanted answers. Why were they separated? Where had they come from? And what were the results of the study? So now all the families jointly contacted the Louise Wise Agency, who admitted that, yes, they participated in a psychological study, but they refused to give any information regarding results or why they did it. The parents hired researchers and detectives who discovered that a man who worked at the agency who oversaw these psychological studies was a guy named Peter Neubauer. And the doctor was famous in New York but refused to answer any questions. Before the doctor died in 2008, he went through legalities to ensure the results would remain sealed in the Yale University archives until 2066. He wanted to make sure that every subject and person involved had all died off and couldn't face prosecution. Well, Neubauer's secretary was tracked down. And although she said she had no knowledge of any experiments, her best guess was that it had something to do with books in his library about nature versus environment. No, nature versus nurture. Are your surroundings what mold you to be who you are? Or is it predetermined genetic makeup that determines who you will be? Are you predestined to become who you're supposed to be despite how you were raised? And she said, it's an interesting question, isn't it? Bobby had been placed into a wealthy household where his father was a doctor and his mother a lawyer. Eddie was placed into a middle-class family where his father worked as a teacher and his mother was a homemaker. David was placed in a low-income household where English was a second language. Where these boys were placed seemed to have no effect on, you know, who they came to be. The kicker is that the adoption agency would send caseworkers to the homes to check up on the children's progress, but it was a ruse to see how the boys were each individually developing in their unique environments, and the parents were none the wiser. The caseworkers would establish a baseline for how each set of parents parented, and then how each triplet responded to that parenting, and if or how it changed their behavior when compared to their brothers. Until the study is published, no one will be able to fully understand why one of the triplets took his own life and why the others did not. If it's all psychological, why just that one boy? There has to be a bit more to it, because other studies have proven that environment does affect psychological behavior. Supposedly, Yale University allowed the remaining brothers to take a glimpse at the file sealed until 2066. The men said the 10,000 documents were useless, full of redactions and written in scientific language that no one short of a prophet could understand. In other words, they were coded by design. They said the documents were useless. The documents did indicate the study ceased in 1980, which was the same year the triplets discovered each other. Louise Wise Services, they suffered a bunch of lawsuits and eventually closed their doors. But the scientists and caseworkers linked to the study suffered no punishment. Now, this is reminiscent of, you know, Project MKUltra experiments, where those scientists were hired, you know, to do the dirty work before walking away. That was their job. Now, there's no telling who outside of Louise Wise was involved, but I doubt the agency came up with the idea all by themselves. And probably just not one scientist. Maybe a scientist who worked for a bigger organization. For the first 10 years of their lives, the siblings were each visited by research assistants led by Dr. Neubauer. And he was like I said before, really well known. He was a prominent child psychologist who had worked closely with Sigmund Freud's daughter, Anna. You know, that era, the 50s and 60s, was the Wild West of psychology. You know, you had the Milgram experiments, you had the Stanford Prison Experiment. You know, they were all under evaluation. And psychology was trying to establish itself as a new science, and people were pushing the envelope. And Neubauer and his associates had approached multiple agencies to participate in the twin study, only to be turned away. The agency would say, you can't split up twins and triplets, what are you thinking? Even at the time of experiments running amok, that was considered pretty extreme. Conducted in the family's homes, caseworker meetings involved cognitive tests such as puzzles and drawings and were always filmed. Behavioral problems were evident almost immediately in the triplets. According to their adoptive parents, as babies, all three would regularly bang their heads against the bars of their cribs in distress. It was observed as possible separation anxiety. When twins or triplets are in the womb, they are reliant on each other for survival. Separating them affects them for the rest of their lives. That has been proved. And mental health issues continued as the boys got older. By the time they were college age, David and Eddie had been in and out of psychiatric hospitals. Bobby was on probation after having pleaded guilty to charges connected to the murder of a woman in a 1978 robbery. Much like the twin girls who contacted the journalist about being separated at birth and facing mental health crises, it seemed the triplets had some uphill battles as well. This made all parties involved want to question what gene pool were they from. The brothers supposedly met their mother briefly. She wasn't in the greatest of health, but explained she was blackout drunk at a high school prom when the triplets were conceived. I mean, Three Identical Strangers, the film, chronicles a story so wild that you just can't believe it's true, but it is. And the documentarian agrees that if he heard someone telling the story, he wouldn't believe it right away. And then, more shocking, the guys go on to discover they were part of this decades-long psychological experiment that had controlled their destiny. Now, the documentarian was able to help them pull a few more additional files. The triplets were born to a teenage girl on July 12, 1961, at Hillside Hospital in Glen Oaks, New York. Split up at 6 months by this now-defunct adoption agency, the boys were raised within 100 miles of each other. None of the adoptive parents knew of the other brothers. You know, inevitably, the researching and loss of Eddie created distance between David and Bobby, and the two rarely speak, although their children do stay in touch. Now, there's a woman named Margie Sandberg, and she knew from the time that she was 7 that she had been adopted. In the 1950s, she was a gifted first grader at the esteemed prep Dalton School in Manhattan. That's the same school you've heard of before. That's the one that Jeffrey Epstein would go on to teach math in 1974 at the age of 21, despite having no college degree, because he was recommended as a teacher by William Barr Sr. And then Epstein got kicked out because of misconduct against female students. Anyway, Sandberg, whose last name was then Marrow, went back to her home on the Upper East Side and asked her parents questions about her adoption. And to her surprise, the parents confessed to adopting both her and her brother in 1946 at the age of 3 months. And the adoption agency explained that both of the parents, who were young California lawyers, had been killed in a car accident. So that cut off any possibility of ever finding them. And Sandberg had a close and loving relationship with her family growing up in, you know, post-World War II New York. Her father was an industrial psychiatrist who authored 11 books. Her mom was a private artist, and when, you know, Margie moved to Berkeley in 1970 and married Joe Sandberg in 1978, even he was curious as to who her biological parents were. And the couple, you know, they started having children, and obviously genetics became a topic of conversation. So Sandberg wrote to the adoption agency seeking further answers, but under New York's closed adoption laws, the agency couldn't release the private information of her parents. It could only give out descriptive information, such as the fact that Sandberg's mother was Jewish, her father was not, her maternal grandfather had been a doctor, and her grandmother had been a therapist. The aunt may have been a famous opera singer, but it was all hearsay. So the PBS show Finding Your Roots stepped in. And the show, which normally, you know, focuses on genealogical research, on celebrities, broadcasted a segment about Sandberg's youngest son, Andy, the comedian, of course. And, you know, Saturday Night Live, Brooklyn 911. And Andy's exceedingly private and had turned down previous requests, but for his mother's sake, for the first time, he caved and agreed to participate in the show. Sandberg had looked at her son and told him, "I would like to see what my mother looked like." So the staff asked Margie for a copy of all the documents she and the detective had received from the Louise Wise Adoption Agency. They also took DNA samples for her and for Andy. And for 6 months, nobody heard anything. Then the show called to schedule a taping in Los Angeles on December 13th, 2017. And the producers asked Sandberg if she wanted to be featured on the show along with her son. She declined her son's appearance, but she would attend. She assumed the request meant there was news about her birth parents. And the show doesn't release any information to families before the taping. So Sandberg took her husband Joe and they met with PBS at a rented home in Los Angeles. And while the host, Harvard professor Skip Gates, was talking on camera in the living room, Sandberg and Joe were following along behind a curtain in the kitchen. And the show reveals each guest's family connections through a book of life it makes. And each page has a photo or document that offers a portal to the past. On the show, which you can find online, Professor Gates asked PBS to show Sandberg her mother. There on the first page was the photo of a young woman with dark eyes, wavy dark hair, and bangs staring back at her. As the tears poured from her eyes, that's all she had wanted, to see her mother, and there she was. She couldn't thank them enough. It was a happy ending to a winding mystery. Those aren't, you know, the only celebrity kind of twin kind of things. You know, you had Elvis and Jesse Presley. Yeah, Elvis Presley had a twin brother, Jesse, who died during childbirth. And Elvis knew, and he brought it up constantly to those around him. And there were even hurtful rumors that circulated about Jesse not dying, but instead being adopted out, since the Presley family was too poor to assume twins. In reality, when Jesse was stillborn, the family couldn't afford a proper burial, so they placed him in a shoebox and buried him in an unmarked grave. And when Elvis exhumed his parents and moved them to Graceland, he wanted to move Jesse, but he couldn't because the grave didn't technically exist. He was buried in an illegal way, but it was the 1930s, and that was overlooked at the time. However, once you do something like that, you understand that you can't come back and legally exhume an unmarked grave. So people who knew Elvis claimed that he carried survivor guilt with him regarding the loss of his twin. He would often explain that it felt like a part of him was missing. He told people that Jesse communicated with him as a voice in his head and even appeared in his dreams. While it sounds crazy, it is a real thing known as the twinless twin phenomenon. And the phenomenon leads surviving twins to feel like they killed their twin in the womb. Or they're, you know, somehow to blame for the other child not making it. Many go on to suffer depression and battle disorders. Elvis's name is an anagram for the word lives, so he felt that he should live life to the fullest for both he and Jesse. You know, he had dreams they would reunite on stage, you know, perform together wearing identical white jumpsuits and matching guitars. Elvis believed that Jesse was the reason he sung well, and he told others that if Jesse was alive, he'd sing better than Elvis. I mean, King siblings, could the world have handled it? But the conspiracy theory is that Elvis used his twin, Jesse, as a body double before he went into hiding. And if you enjoy kind of mysterious theories surrounding the king having not left the building, so to say, then there's a Facebook group for you. It's called Evidence Elvis Presley's Alive. And they've come up with everything you could possibly think of in vivid detail. There's a really, really famous set of identical siblings way back in the 30s, the Dion sisters. And in 1934, this French family was already parents to five children. And on May 28, 1934, the 34-year-old wife discovered, hey, I'm pregnant. And this time she bore the first identical quintuplets known to have survived their infancy. And they were born in Ontario, near the village of Corbeil. And all five children survived to adulthood, which was a huge deal. And the wife suspected she was carrying twins, but she had no idea that quintuplets were even possible. And the wife reported having cramps in her third month and passing a strange object, which may have been a sixth fetus. And Dr. Alan Roy Defoe, is credited with ensuring the successful live birth of the quintuplets. And out of the five, there are two that are still living. One died in 2001, one died in 1954, and one died in 1970. And Emily and Marie shared an embryonic sac. Annette and Yvonne shared an embryonic sac. And it is believed that Cecile shared an embryonic sac with the miscarried sixth baby. And the quintuplets' total weight at birth was 13 pounds, 6 ounces for five of them. And all but Emily were later discovered to be right-handed, and all but Marie had a counterclockwise kind of whirl in their hair. And the babies were kept in a wicker basket borrowed from the neighbors, covered with heated blankets, and they were brought into the kitchen and set by the stove to keep warm. And one by one, they were taken out of the basket and massaged with olive oil. Every 2 hours for the first 24, they were fed water sweetened with corn syrup. And by the second day, they were moved to a slightly larger laundry basket and kept warm with hot water bottles. They were watched constantly, often had to be roused. They were then fed with 720 formula, cow's milk, boiled water, 2 spoonfuls of corn syrup, and 1 or 2 drops of rum for a stimulant. And they were, the quintuplets were approached by Chicago Century Fair of Progress exhibitors. And after living 4 months with their French-speaking farming family, there was a knock at the door, and it was the Century Fair. And it was only within, you know, days of the girl's birth they had shown up, and here they were again. They wanted to put the quintuplets on display and show them to the world. And at the time, it wasn't unusual for incubator babies to be displayed at fairs and exhibitions. But the parents, they didn't want to sign the contract, but were essentially coerced, persuaded to accept the offer by, you know, their delivery doctor and the family priest. Probably got kickbacks. And the Dions revoked the contract, citing that both parents wouldn't sign it, but the tour bureau claimed otherwise. And then on July 27, 1934, the Ontario government stepped in and passed the Dion Quintuplets Guardianship Act, which made the children wards of the crown until their mid-teens. So the provincial government and those around them began to profit by making the children a significant tourist attraction. The children were essentially being raised to display, to be gawked at and looked at. And once the guardianship bill was signed, the parents lost custody of the children until they were 18. In return, the Red Cross would cover all medical costs, including nurses, wages, supplies, and ensuring that enough breast milk was being shipped to the hospital. They also oversaw the building of a hospital built specifically for the Dion quintuplets. And the government realized there was enormous public interest in the quintuplets and proceeded to profit from a tourist industry geared around them. And the Dions traveled to Chicago as parents of the world-famous babies and made stage appearances. The premier of Ontario at the time, Mitchell Hepburn, used the Dion vaudeville trip as an excuse to extend the guardianship. He claimed they must save the babies from further exploitation. And, you know, I mean, this is crazy. The girls were moved from their quiet family farmhouse to this nursery, and they lived there until they were 9 years old. And the compound featured an outdoor playground designed to allow the public to observe the children at all times they were outdoors. And this was all funded through a Red Cross fundraiser. And the sisters were brought to the playground 2 or 3 times a day and paraded before a crowd. And the yards and buildings were surrounded by a 7-foot barbed wire fence fully staffed with maids, nurses, and policemen. The sisters were constantly tested and studied and examined, with records being recorded of everything they did. The children were kept on a strict routine. Approximately 3,000 people per day visited the observation gallery that surrounded the outdoor viewing area. Sometimes the mother of the girls stopped by to work at the souvenir shop called Quintland. And Quintland was Ontario's biggest tourist attraction of the era, even surpassing the Canadian side of Niagara Falls. Amelia Earhart also visited just 6 weeks before she disappeared forever in 1937. There was lots of Hollywood stars who visited. Clark Gable, James Stewart, Betty Davis, James Cagney, Mae West. And once Hollywood came along, the pint-sized children were dubbed kidfluencers. So they appeared in commercials for Kara corn syrup, Quaker Oats, Colgate, Palmolive, I mean, just everything. They were even in 3 Hollywood films, which were essentially fictionalized versions of their stories. They played the Wyatt quintuplets in all 3 films. It was The Country Doctor, Reunion, and 5 of Kind, all kind of done in the mid-30s. And since they were quite young, they merely kind of were just there. They were just playing. They weren't acting. But they were there, and that's all people cared about. And they were in numerous newsreels and documentaries before finally returning to their parents. By November 1943, the entire Dion family was reunited and living under the same roof. At some point, the girls began to realize their self-worth and how their finances supported the family. And they resented their parents for living off of them. And the quintuplets left the family home when they turned 18 years old in 1952 and had little contact with their parents afterwards. You know, three went on to marry and have children. And then, you know, passed away from natural causes and seizures. And in 1995, the three surviving sisters alleged that their father had sexually abused them during their teenage years. And in 1998, they participated in an hour-long documentary, Full Circle, The Untold Story of the Dion Quintuplets, which was broadcast on CBC. And remember, they had brothers and sisters. There was five of them. And they denied that the girls were ever touched and said it was an invented memory to keep the custody arrangement in place. They claimed that their father never abused any of his children. In 1997, they wrote an open letter to the parents of the McCaughey septuplets, warning against too much publicity for their children. You know, dear Bobby and Kenny, if we emerge momentarily from the privacy we have sought all our adult lives, it is only to send a message to your family. You know, and basically said, hey, don't make money off your kids. Don't exploit them. But in 1998, the sisters reached a $2.8 million settlement with the Ontario government as compensation for their exploitation. As of December 2019, there were only, like I said, two surviving sisters. And there is a museum dedicated to the twins in their hometown. In 2016, Brooke Shields and Beau Bridges visited the museum when they were in the area filming a movie. Bridges had played Dr. Defoe in the TV movie Million Dollar Babies, and Shields and Brooke's interest in the quintuplets stemmed from her mother's interest in them. So, what about the Iron Mask? You know, there's been plenty of movies and stuff about the Iron Mask. Is it bro or is it foe? Because historians are still trying to figure out who the unidentified man in the Iron Mask was. You know, the mask wasn't actually iron. It was misidentified by Voltaire. It was actually black velvet, but the prisoner who donned the mask was shielded, regardless. No one ever saw his face, not even his guards. But why? Who was the man? Was he a nobleman? Was he a traitor? Was he the king's brother? Could have rocked the royal pecking order to the French throne. One thing is for sure, the prisoner was thought to harbor dangerous information related to the country. That rumor stuck the very first day the mysterious man was arrested and booked. The arrest occurred in 1669 or 1670 and resulted in the prisoner being held in a number of French prisons, including the Bastille and the fortress of Pignerol, until his death in 1703. And he was buried under the name Marchioli, and this was all during the reign of King Louis XIV of France. And the governor of the prison was given strict orders not to allow the prisoner to speak to anyone unless it was regarding food or drink. If the prisoner spoke out of turn, the guards were ordered to kill him on the spot. The prisoner never said anything toward it. He never tried. The prisoner wore the mask for some 30 years before perishing. Was the mask to silence him or shield his identity? Maybe both. Who would have recognized him? If he wasn't noble and he wasn't the king's twin, how had his face sinned? The true identity of the prisoner remains a mystery to this day. His identity has been extensively debated by historians, and various theories have been expounded. Some people speculated it was a count who had attempted to double-cross the king, or even perhaps Eustache d'Alger, a man who was involved in several 17th-century political scandals known as the Affairs of the Poisons. Allegations of poisonings, witchcraft, and murders committed by high-class aristocracy. Others firmly believe the prisoner was the older illegitimate brother of Louis XIV, who could have shifted the historical monarchy and throne. And documents reveal that King Louis XIV diverted funds to personally pay for the prisoner's upkeep. But sometimes the guards would steal the funds instead of passing them on to the prisoner. Louis XIV went to extreme lengths to prepare the jail for the mysterious masked man. He ordered multiple cell doors installed, one closing upon the other, to prevent anyone from eavesdropping on conversations from the outside. And the guard assigned to the masked prisoner was to provide food and whatever else the prisoner needed without ever looking at his face. The prison was told to kill the masked man if he spoke of anything, remember, other than food or water. In a 1965 essay, a French novelist supported the theory that the man in the iron mask was Louis XIV's twin brother, but born second. Since he was younger, he would have been hidden to avoid any dispute over the throne holder. The only problem with the theory is the fact that witnesses were present for the queen's birth. Why hadn't the witnesses ever mentioned a twin? I mean, Louis was born late into his mother's marriage. Could she even have had twins? Another theory is that the man in the iron mask was the natural father of Louis XIV. According to this theory, the miraculous birth of Louis XIV in 1638 would have come after Louis XIII had been estranged from his wife, Anne of Austria, for 14 years. How did the union produce a king? It's suggested that the king minister arranged for an illegitimate son, Henry IV, to become intimate with the queen and father and heir to the throne. Supposedly, the substitute father left for the Americas, but returned to France with the aim of extorting money in exchange for keeping his secret, and he was promptly imprisoned. This theory would explain the secrecy surrounding the prisoner, whose true identity would have destroyed the legitimacy of Louis XIV's claim to the throne, had it been revealed. Even after his death, the government took great care to hide the identity. His clothes were promptly burned at dawn, his cell was immediately scraped and painted, and the French bureaucratic system worked very hard to ensure no one ever knew the real story behind the man in the iron mask. I mean, regardless of what theory you go with, it doesn't seem like something was quite right about Louis XIV assuming the throne. All right, you guys. I will talk to you later.